going to present today some work done in collaboration with Bianca Dietrich, Fran Ecker, Eric Snetter, and Sebastian Steinhaus. Let me start first with a brief introduction. So as we know, spin-form models are non-perturbative candidates for quantum gravity, so they attempt to provide a microscopic description of space-time. I'm not sure the mic is working. Is it? Okay. Okay, thank you. These models introduce a regularization for the path integral of gravity that is based on a discretization of space-time. More specifically, spin-form models are defined on two complexes. Unlike standard lattice gate theories, spin-form models are background independent. Then we can regard them as generalized lattice gate theories. Because of the discretization in general, diffeomorphism symmetry is broken. And then one of the main open questions about the spin-forms is whether diffeomorphism symmetry is restored in the large scale limit given by considering many building blocks and small discretization scales. In other words, the question is whether the spin forms flow under renormalization to a continuum space-time. The complexity of spin form models have prevented so far an explicit study. In this talk, we face this question by analyzing simplified models which capture the essential features of spin forms. The simplifications that I am going to consider are the following. First, I will replace Lie groups by finite groups. I will also consider a regular lattice instead of a general to complex. And finally, I will introduce a dimensional reduction from two complexes to one complex. This defines so-called spin-net models. Spin-net models, even though they are much simpler than spin-form models, retain the main ingredient of spin forms, in particular the simplicity constraints. And thanks to their simplicity, it is doable to analyze the renormalization flow under cross-graining of spin-net models just using techniques that have been already developed in condensed matter and statistical physics. In particular, today we will see how to apply tensor network methods to analyze the behavior of spin-net models under cross-graining, and also the question about restoration of symmetries in the continuum limit. By the way, if you have questions, you can interrupt me at any moment. Okay, this is the outline of my talk. First, I will review very briefly the main ingredients of spin forms. I won't enter into many details, but if you are interested, tomorrow we have, I think, two plenary talks on spin forms. Then I will define spin-net models. I will show you then how to employ the tensor network renormalization group approach to cross-grain spin-net models. And I will particularize the study to spin-nets based on the simplest non-abelian group, the group of permutations of three elements. And I will finish with an outlook and some conclusions. Okay. So as I told you before, we can regard spin-forms as generalized lattice gate theories. So let's start by reviewing the basic ingredients of standard lattice gate theories. Standard lattice gate theories are states and models defined on two complexes. Given a group G, in these theories we attach a group element to every edge of the two complex and a phase weight to every phase of the two complex. The partition function is given by this expression, where the phase weights are evaluated on the holonomy of the phases. These phase weights are class functions on the group G. For the cross-graining algorithms that I'm going to introduce later, it is convenient to do a change from this group elements representation to the representations in terms of the dual variables, namely in terms of the irreducible representations of the group. In this representation, we attach irreducible representations labels to the faces of the two complex, the duals of these face weights to the faces and intertwiners to the edges. In a standard lattice gauge theory, these intertwiners are given by the Hart projector, namely by the projector that projects on the invariant subspace of the tensor product of the representation spaces of these irreducible representations that meet in the edge. Okay, so now, okay, I forgot to say, for standard lattice gauge theories, the definition of this dual weight usually introduces the scale of the lattice, so it is not background independent. This is something to avoid if we want to quantize gravity, because gravity should be background independent. So, in spin forms, we first particularize these dual weights to the identity to avoid that background dependence. The non-triviality of the models comes by replacing the Hart projector by another projector, a projector in a smaller subspace. So in particular, well, we can think of this intertwiner as having this form, where these P's are the Hart projector, but then we insert some weights attached to the faces, and these weights indeed encode the simplicity constraints. Okay, so while analyzing the cost ranging of spin form models, then we expect, well, we will find the same fixed points and faces of those of standard lattice gauge theory. These faces are a topological BF face, because, well, we have a topological BF fixed point that corresponds to the weak coupling limit of standard lattice gauge theory. And this is just defined by considering this intertwiner equal to the Hart projector. We also have another fixed point that in gravity would correspond to a degenerate phase, and in a standard lattice gauge theory, this is the strong coupling limit or the confining limit for lattice QCD. And this is just defined by freezing all the representation labels here to the trivial representation. So the question is whether spin forms present any additional fixed point or any additional phase. Okay, so now I'm going to introduce spin net models. They are just given by a dimensional reduction of spin forms carried out by considering, instead of two complices, one complice. Namely, for spin nets, we have irreducible representations of the group attached to the edges of a graph and intertwiners attached to the vertices. As a consequence of this reduction, the local gauge symmetry of spin forms gets translated into a global symmetry for spin nets. Interestingly, there exists a similarity between four-dimensional standard lattice gauge theories and the corresponding two-dimensional edge models. And we hope that this similarity also holds for spin forms and spin nets. Okay, so as for spin forms, in general, the intertwiner that we attach to every vertex is not the Hart projector, but it comes with an E tilde function inserted in each edge that encodes the simplicity constraints of the model. Written in this form, the spin net models are actually vertex models. We can see them as, if we see these intertwiners as tensors, the partition function is just the tensor trace over a tensor of network of tensors, and the network is just given by the connectivity of the lattice. In the following, I'm going to restrict the study to a regular square lattice. So the partition function is just the tensor trace of this network of tensors. In every vertex, then, we have a four-valent tensor. This four-valent tensor lives in the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces attached to every edge. These Hilbert spaces are given by this expression, where V rho is just the representation of a space of the reducible representation rho, and rho star is the dual of rho. So in every edge, we have this algebraic data attached. We have an irreducible representation and two magnetic indices. In this basis, actually, the tensor has a complicated form, and it is more suitable to go to the recoupling basis. Indeed, thanks to the due to the global gauge invariance of spin nets, we notice that the representation 1 and 2 have to couple to the same representation as representations 3 and 4. I call that representation rho t here. So if we do a change from this basis to the recoupling basis, we will see that the tensor diagonalizes per blocks. So in other words, the spin representation in the recoupling basis optimizes, let's say, the number of variables that we need to characterize our tensors. So let's do this change of basis. This is given just by introducing Kless-Gordan coefficients. So here I just saw an example of coupling representation rho 1 with rho 2, and we will have two Kless-Gordan coefficients, one for the left copy, let's say, and another one for the prime copy. So if I do this change of basis in my tensor, what I have to do is just contracting Kless-Gordan coefficients with the edges of the tensor. For the coarse graining algorithm that I will explain later, I need to define two different kinds of couplings. First, the tensor given by coupling first this representation rho 1 with rho 2 and rho 3 with rho 4, both of them going to the intertwiner channel rho t prime. And also I need this other kind of recoupling of the representation 2 with 3 and representation 1 with 4. I will call this tensor C1 and this tensor C2. So as we notice that thanks to the global gauge invariance, these objects do not depend on the magnetic indices MT and NT prime. So we get a tensor that is a block diagonal, where the blocks are labeled by these indices here, which just characterize the intertwiner channel. Okay, actually there is a very nice relation between these two tensors that is given here. So we see that from tensor C1, I can get C2 just by convoluting C1 with the 6J recoupling symbols corresponding to the group. Okay, so now once I have defined my spinnet models in a very nice representation, I'm gonna introduce the coarse graining scheme. Here we are gonna apply a blocking procedure based in tensor network methods. These methods are very nice because they can deal with complex amplitudes, and also they offer us a direct access to the structure of fixed points. The idea is the following. I have my lattice here with tensors in every vertex, and what we would like to do is summarize pair of edges to get an effective edge. But in doing this grouping of edges, I need to introduce a truncation, because the range of indices of the effective edges grow exponentially. So if we want this grouping to be a feasible task for a computer, and being able to do it with a computer, we need to introduce a truncation. But a truncation retaining the relevant degrees of freedom. In other words, we need to introduce an isometry or an embedding map that relates the coarser structure with the finer structure, so that groups the original edges to a new effective edge whose range goes from 1 to certain cutoff that we call the bond dimension. I think Bianca will talk more about embedding maps and cylindrical consistency, so I won't enter too much here about the interpretation of these embedding maps. So now the question is how to do the truncation such that the approximation is good. In other words, how to do the truncation such that we really retain the relevant degrees of freedom. And to do that, what we do is introducing a singular value decomposition. In the literature, there are many tensor renormalization methods, and here today I will employ the so-called tensor renormalization group approach. It consists in the following steps. First, we regard our tensors as matrices. Namely, given, for instance, this tensor, we group this pair of indices in the first index of a matrix, M1, and this pair of indices, Rho3 and Rho4, in the second index of a matrix, M1. And then, as I told you before, these indices only label blocks. So what I get in a matricial form, my tensor in matricial form, is just a matrix that is diagonal per blocks. We do the same for the second type of tensor, just that now we group in the first index representations 2 and 3, and in the second index representations 4 and 1. Once I have my tensors written in matricial form, I can employ a singular value decomposition of each block. Namely, we get, this can be seen graphically in the following way. Having the matrix M1, I just do an splitting in 2 3-valent tensors, S1 and S2. And here I get an internal index whose range goes from 1 till certain cutoff. Here is where I impose my truncation. And then we do the same for the second type of tensor. Namely, we introduce an splitting, 2 3-valent tensors that I will call S3 and S4. Okay. Once we have these splittings, we alternate them in our original lattice to go from the 4-valent vertex lattice to a 3-valent vertex lattice. And once we have this picture, now we can carry out a contraction here in this square. So we carry out the contraction and we get a new 4-valent vertex that now is my effective vertex. And this scheme leads to a coarser lattice than the original one. Okay. All this procedure applied to our spin nets leads to the following flow equation. So we had, from our original tensor, we do the singular value decomposition and we get the 3-valent tensors S1, S2, S3, S4. And from there, we get the new effective tensor by convoluting them with 9J symbols. In turn, these 9Js split in 6J symbols. So we get a very nice equation in terms of the original ingredients of the tensors and just 6J recoupling symbols. Okay, thank you. This new effective tensor has a more general structure than the original one. As we see now, on every edge, I get three algebraic data attached to it. The original representation row, a different representation row prime, and a multiplicity index that goes from 1 to the bond dimension corresponding to the intertwiner channel row 1 prime. And this for every edge. So under coarse graining, we see that the Hilbert space attached to its edge gets more general than the one we started from. Therefore, under coarse graining, we obtain an enlarged space of models. So I want to emphasize again that here, this representation rho prime is in general different from this representation rho. From the effective tensor 1, I can now compute the effective tensor 2 by the expression I showed you before, this one here. And then again, I can do the singular value decomposition to get the new 3-valent tensors S1, 2, 3, and 4. And I can iterate this process to analyze the coarse graining of my models. OK. This structure that I mentioned, that the space of models gets more general, is also displayed here graphically. So this is what I said before. This is my original tensor with this Hilbert space attached to every edge, and under cross-grain in the Hilbert space is more general. If we reduce to the case for which rho prime is the dual of rho, then we reduce to the case of standard lattice gate theory. So in general, if we want to allow for non-trivial simplicity constraints, we will get that rho prime is different from the dual of rho. We can also define factorizing models, models for which rho and rho prime get totally decoupled, and then in that case we can just consider one copy. This is actually related with models of condensed matter called anion models, which represent particles coupled to Chern-Simons, and interestingly these models present in the continuum limit massless excitations and a Hamiltonian that is topologically protected. In other words, under perturbations, the Hamiltonian still leads to massless excitation, so it doesn't need a fine-tuning in order to lead to massless excitations. It would be very interesting if this kind of behavior also happens for gravity. Okay, now then that I have introduced the coarse-graining algorithm, I'm going to apply it to spin-net models defined on the group S3. This is the group of permutations of three elements and is the simplest group with intertwiner degrees of freedom because it is non-abelian. It is formed by six elements, the identity, three odd permutations, and two even permutations. The corresponding irreducible representations are three: the trivial representation, a signed representation, and are another representation that I think in the literature is called a standard representation. And unlike the trivial one and the signed representation, the standard representation is two-dimensional. Here I show you the coupling rules for the non-trivial representations, and notice that the coupling rule of three with three leads to three different channels. So now, in order to define our models, we just need to specify these functions E tilde that implement the simplicity constraints. In our case, we define our models in the following way. So we are going to consider that the off-diagonal entries vanish. For those that are more familiar with the holonomy representation, this is totally equivalent to consider an E function that is invariant under conjugation with respect to the group elements of the group set 2, which is a subgroup of the group S3. Okay, fixing some normalization condition, I can actually parameterize my models by three parameters, alpha, beta, and gamma. And here, I display the phase space that I encounter in the case of standard lattice gate models, which corresponds to the case alpha equal to beta. In this diagram, we have three obvious points, three standard fixed points, which are a topological, or if you want, topological BF fixed point, or if you want, a low temperature fixed point, which corresponds to S3 order, which is in this corner here. Then we have what we call a high temperature fixed point, which corresponds to a phase with disorder. This is a point with alpha, beta, and gamma equal to 1, so like over there. And finally, we also find BF on the subgroup set 2, which is defined by these parameters, alpha, beta equal to 0, and gamma equal to 1. And here I display, so all the models in the blue region flow to BF under cross-graining, all the models in the green region flow to BF on set 2, and all the models in the yellow region flow to high temperature. And here I just show some models that flow like this flow to any of these phases, but we see they define phase transitions. We have phase transitions among all the pairs of phases. Okay, so this is about standard models, but what about non-standard ones, models that have actually non-trivial simplicity constraints? For instance, we can define an analog to the Barrett Crane model, analog in the sense that it is defined by considering that the representation 2, namely the sine representation, does not appear, is forbidden. That model is defined by these values for the parameters. And when we flow these models, the non-standard models, unfortunately, we don't get extra phases. All our models parameterized by alpha, beta, and gamma flow either to BF or to high temperature or to BF on set 2. In particular, our Barrett-Crane analog flows to BF, and you would think that's boring. Okay, in first place it's boring, but actually we really find more non-trivial physics. Oh, I need to speed up. So we find that this Barrett-Crane analog flows actually very close to the phase transition. And indeed, if I put a small bond, low bond dimension, for a low bond dimension, the Barrett-Crane analog didn't flow to any of these standard fixed points, but it flowed to a non-standard fixed point without the sine representation, namely to a non-standard fixed point that respects the simplicity constraints of my Barrett-Crane analog. So this was really a very interesting result. So let's analyze in a bit more detail this BF high temperature phase transition. So we see that we need to fine tune to go away from the dominating phases and really to go to the phase transition. As this is nothing surprising, also Dario told us today that they need to fine tune to go to the phase transition. So here we see the same behavior. Let me emphasize that it is important to move away from the standard lattice gate theory fixed points. And I would like to note that linearizations around these standard fixed points only allow for rho prime equal to rho star. For instance, Migdal, Cardano like approximations never consider that they could be different. So if we really want to go close to a phase transition with like simplicity constraints play a role there, we need to allow for this situation. We see our experience, I mean, when running the simulations, when we analyze all the iterations, we see that near the phase transition, indeed, the number of iterations to reach convergence increases. And even if after convergence we flow either to BF or to high temperature, for a very long range of iterations, we see that our models present like kind of a plateau behavior. So they remain in a different quasi-fixed point, let's say. Okay, and as I say, this phase transition line might have more structure as the additional fixed point that we found suggests. Let's analyze now this non-standard fixed point. It is defined by having singular value equal to 1 in these blocks. So as I told you, the representation 2 does not appear there. It is forbidden. So it respects the simplicity constraints of our Barrett-Crane analog. And it is outside the range of our original models, as our original models had rho prime equal to rho star. The analysis of the structure of the fixed point reveals that it has a factorizing form. So we can just consider one of these copies. And actually, if we split these four valent tensors into three valent ones, we see that these three valent tensors define a triangulation independent model. So this is a very interesting property. All the fixed points that we find are triangulation independent. Okay, so do I have, how long do I have? 1 minute. In 1 minute I will tell you what are the new promising paths that we plan to follow for future research. So we have seen actually that it seems that the biggest singular value in each block already retains the most interesting physics. So what we plan to do now is just keeping a single singular value in each block and develop semi-analytical approximations. So this will give us, if we do this, we will be able to do flow lines and really to get like Migdal Kadanoff type equations for the dynamics of our intertwiners. We also plan to to employ other contraction schemes, in particular schemes that allow us to go to higher dimensions. I don't really have time to explain this, but this is an example of that. Okay. We also plan to put as input more general models, actually models that allow for rho prime different from rho. And if we start with this initial space of parameters, then we will find a richer Weiss diagram. As Sebastian told us yesterday, we are also working now on quantum groups SU2 with Q at the root of unity, and also we will define their analogs of Barrett-Crane and EPRL. We will also like to define observables and analyze the flow and the random and the coarse graining for these observables. And after all, we would like to apply the lessons learned with spin nets to actual spin forms. So just, do we have time? No. I think I don't have time to read the conclusions, but this is just a summary of all the results I told you about. Thank you very much.
The simplification, the dimensional reduction from passing to spin foam to spin net. I was wondering what would be the physical interpretation of that? It seems to me it's as if you're kind of cutting out time, you kill time, you kill the time dimension. Is that correct?
No. So you could think as this, as a spin network, because it has spins attached to edges and intertwinings attached to vertices, but actually these intertwiners encode the dynamics. So geometrically, I mean, these are not models of quantum gravity because of this this dimensional reduction, but I mean, they encode all the dynamics, and they're simpler than spin forms because of the reduction. But they really, I mean, it's not that I kill time. You could see this is two dimensional, but it's covariant. So you could see one direction spatial and the other direction time, okay? So they really encode dynamics. And an interesting feature is what I said here, that it would be great if we have a similarity between 2D spinnet models and 4D spin form models. We don't know if that's true, but there are, in the literature, it has been reported that there is that similarity happens for standard lattice gate theories. And since the ingredients are kind of the same, we hope that similarity holds.
Do you have any model that we can solve analytically?
Ising model can be solved analytically, but if I go to non-abelian groups, yeah, Ising model corresponds to the group set 2. And yeah, that can be solved analytically. Indeed. It's like the test bed for these methods. The first thing we do is put in Ising to see if we can reproduce the results of Ising model.
So I also have a question. So at the point where you need to devise a truncation that captures the relevant physical degrees of freedom, when I understood you correctly, the tensor network renormalization somehow does that for you automatically. Well, can you give a physical intuition for how exactly that works?
Well, it's not really automatic.
Non-perturbative regime, I'd say. Non-trivial to do that.
Sure. So, yeah, when I go to the matricial form and I do the singular value decomposition, I kind of lose track of what were my initial parameters, and I might lose track of what are the meaning of the degrees of freedom that I am encoding. But actually, so what we are doing here is really encoding the degrees of freedoms of intertwiners in the components of the singular vectors and in the components of the singular values. So when I do the singular value decomposition, the components of the singular vectors really, from those I could really recover the intertwiner. And then I put there the truncation. Yeah, I kind of lose interpretation, but still from that I can recover the intertwiner. It's difficult to see what the truncation does. But it's really the proper thing to do, because I am really disregarding singular values that are smaller than the ones I am considering.
Good. So let's thank Marissa again.
Oh, sorry.
Thanks. So, hi, thanks for attending this talk. I will introduce briefly like some renormalization work on so-called tensorial group field theories. So maybe many of you have not been exposed to these theories yet, but you will be soon, so tomorrow. And I will try my best to fill the gap here for now. So, on this. Okay. So, what are group field theories first? So, they are contour field theories that generate spin foams as amplitudes. So, they are one way of summing of fully defining spin foam models, if you want, by summing over them. So, the alternative would be to coarse graining them or refining them. So, this is a second position that you can adopt. And if you do so, you are led to try to define these group field theories are as proper quantum field theories. So in particular, you want them to be renormalizable. So unfortunately, these theories are quite complex. And so far, this renormalizability question was not really addressed. And this is kind of a long-term goal in this approach is to define a group field theory which is renormalizable in some sense and for 4D quantum gravity. So recent progress has been triggered by significant work on tensor models, and that's why we have added the term tensorial to name a particular subclass of group field theories that are easier to understand, and in particular, the notion of renormalizability could be defined in this context. So, and that's it. So, okay. So, what is the path we are trying to follow? So, we are starting from the simplest tensorial group field theories that have been defined, which are 2 years old only, and where of a purely combinatorial type, and I will explain what it means later. And our contribution with Daniele Oriti and Vincent Rivasso was to reintroduce back like connection degrees of freedom, like the group elements into the picture, so as to have non-trivial spin foam models, not purely combinatorial amplitudes. And in the future, we should probably address the question of simplicity constraints and maybe try to systematize the computations made by Aldo. Okay. So what is the structure of a tensorial group field theory? So it is a quantum field theory of one complex field, which is defined on D copies of a compact group G. And I will call big D the dimension of the group. And small d is supposed to be the dimension of space-time. So then the dynamics is defined by a partition function Z. And I use the following convention. S here is just the interaction part of the action. And the free theory is completely encoded in a Gaussian measure, d mu c, which defines the propagator C. And so if you want to start like a renormalization study, we should provide a prescription for the interaction terms that you can have in your theory, and this will be a generalization of locality. So I will use the term local for the terms that you can put in the interaction. So they don't have to be understood as locality in the space-time sense. So yes. And okay, so why do we call these theories tensorial group field theories? Because the locality we are using is based on tensor invariants, so which has been first defined in the context of tensor models. And what is it? So you assume that S is a sum of connected tensor invariants, IB, where B is the set B is a set of colored graphs which index the possible invariants. So here is an example of colored graphs with the dimension 4. And so what is it? It's a regular graph of valency D, the dimension of the of spacetime ultimately, bipartite, which means that you have two kinds of nodes, black and white, and edge colored. And how do you map the drawing to the possible invariant that you are putting in your action is as follows. So to each white dot, you associate a field, and to each black dot, a conjugate field, for example, here. And then you draw a line of color L when you convolute two indices in the position L in the tensor, so to speak. So for example, this field and this field are convoluted with respect to G1, G2, and G3 here. You see here. Okay. So this is the locality prescription. Now let's look at what we use as a kinematics. So the first tensor group field theories which have been defined were defined with one non-trivial propagator constructed out of the Laplacian on the group. And so the idea is to superimpose on this thing a gauge invariance condition coming from spin foams. So this is a condition that the fields should verify on shell, so to speak, and which introduces at the level of the amplitudes a discrete gauge connection, so via the variables H here. So it's a kind of invariance on the field. So what we do is just to take this operator and then average it in this sense. So here's the definition. This is the propagator. So it takes three variables on one side and propagates them to D other variables. And how? So you have a product of heat kernels on the group at some parameter alpha. And then you average over the group. So this is this H here. And finally, you integrate over the alpha parameter. OK. And so for example, if you want to compare with the usual field theories on spacetime, you just delete this H, and set D equal 1, for example. And G is some is in R4, for example. OK. So what are the amplitudes of such a theory? So they are indexed by also colored graphs, but D plus 1 colored graphs this time, because each interaction is a colored graph with D colors. And then you add on top of that the propagators, which are represented as dashed lines. And so I don't want to go too much into the details, but the important aspect of these graphs is the notion of phase. So what is a phase? So the lines are the dashed lines. So I call them L. And the faces are sets of lines which form in the color representation faces. So what is a face? For example, a face of color 3 here in blue is a circuit of dashed lines and color 3 lines, internal lines. So here you have a face of color 3, and here, which is closed. Here, for example, you have a face of color 4 in red, which is open. And the amplitudes are constructed out of the faces. So what it means is that just a drawing like that represents a particular kind of two complex. And then the amplitude of the two complex is the spin foam amplitude. So, and it has, so this doesn't matter, but the idea is really that it is the amplitude of the Bulatov spin foam model, Bulatov type spin foam model, except that the flatness of the holonomies is not imposed by delta functions, but heat kernels, at a certain parameter times, and these parameters are integrated over. Like, so this is a kind of a integrated version of a Buletov model. And this alpha parameter is what causes these amplitudes are generically divergent, and the divergences come from alpha close to zero. So we should cut off the region alpha close to zero and study renormalizability in this context. Okay. So what we achieved with these models, first is we were able to compute a degree of divergence, very general, in terms of the combinatorial data of the graphs. So L is the number of lines. D, big D is the dimension of the group, F the number of internal faces, and R is a rank of some matrix which tells you what is the incidence between lines and faces in your two complex. And if you rewrite this degree, so when omega is bigger than zero, the graph is divergent, or otherwise it's convergent. So you should look at when is omega positive. And so to classify the possible type of just renormalizable theories that we can construct in this class of models, we can rewrite the degree in terms of like the number of external legs of the graph, or the number of nodes or vertices of a given valency, 2k here. And the condition that you should impose is that you have a decay in the number of external legs, and also a decay in the number of vertices. Otherwise, you have an okay. And otherwise, the degree is unbounded from above. So if you do that, you can show that there is only five possibilities for the dimensions of the group and of spacetime. And that's it. So, and the particular model we constructed is this one, D equals 3 and big D equals 3, which is, if you look at it, the only model where you can have a group G which can be interpreted as the symmetry group of the spacetime. So here in three dimensions, you have, for example, the symmetry group SU2 and this match. If you look at four dimensions, for example, the maximal dimension of the group you can get is dimension 2. So you cannot construct a model in this class. Okay. So let's go to the model in question. So it is renormalizable to phi 6 interactions. So here I've drawn all the possible structure for the bubbles, the possible interactions. And it turns out that you can and you should actually restrict yourself to only these four. The sixth one, which is a kind of pathological because it's not positive and it doesn't represent well-behaved triangulations, can be avoided. So the general action that you should work with is the sum of these four invariants. And because there will be also wave function counter terms, you can add a wave function term here, which is not tensor invariant, but it can be reabsorbed in the covariance. Okay, so just to give you an idea of what's going on here, We have a kind of classification of the type of divergences you can have, and you see that the phi 6 interactions are log divergent, and that the 2-point functions can be quadratically divergent. So you have a wave function renormalization. A specific feature of these models I would like to comment on is that contrary to usual quantum field theories, the divergent I pieces of the amplitudes are not automatically quasi-local. So they don't look automatically local. Why? Well, this is due to the internal structures of the interactions and the fact that the amplitudes are constructed out of the faces, not out of the lines, to speak. And And because of that, we had to impose an additional condition on the amplitudes, which should be verified in a randomizable model. So I don't enter the details, but in a sense, the idea is that when you have a divergent graph like this one, seen from the external legs, you should be able to say that at high energy, the parallel transport between here and here is trivial. So if you cannot do that, you cannot reinterpret this divergent term as just a single vertex. So that's one thing. And luckily, so for this particular model, all the graphs are tracial. So they are well behaved. And they are of a particular type called melonic. And so if you look at our paper, you can find all the details of this study. And so it has been, just to mention briefly, it's the proof of renormalizability is done with in the context of a multi-scale expansion, and I don't enter the details, and which has been adapted to this special feature that the faces play a fundamental role in this model. And an ongoing work is to really study the renormalization group flow and determine whether the model is asymptotically free. And so first, preliminary calculations tend to show that it is, but I don't want to. Okay, and so just the conclusions. What the message I would like to give is really that. So now we have a general randomization scheme for TGFTs, which are non-trivial. That is, they have gauge connection, discrete gauge connections, and in particular, we could construct a TGFT version of the Bulatov model, which is renormalization and has a non-trivial flow. And so I think it's probably time to go to the hard stuff, like 4D quantum gravity models, and try to see what the simplicity constraints change into this picture. So thank you.
Constraints relating on what you can have for the dimension of the group and the dimension of space-time. Yeah. So
in four it was two. So it means that you could not construct along these lines the TGFT randomizable model analog to the Oguri model.
For example.
It seems that you need more constraints. So maybe it's a good sign in a sense.
So can we interpret this as indication for asymptotic safety in gravity from a totally different perspective?
I wouldn't trust myself on it. Yeah, but it's not the same perturbative expansion, right? I mean, it's not perturbative around some backgrounds or some so I don't know how to interpret it, but because the notion of scale is pretty abstract. It's just the spectrum of some operator, and it's not really related to energy in the sense of space-time or also it's. It's a long way, I think, to interpret this.
So it depends. So these constraints depend on the fact that you don't have. It's for that BF model.
Yeah.
Specifically, right? So
Simplicity
constraints, those.
That would change. I mean, naively, you could try to extrapolate the result, and you would be disappointed. But I think you shouldn't because.
Thanks. Right. So I'm going to talk about the renormalization group flow of the cosmological constant in causal dynamical triangulation. So let me just begin with a brief introduction.
All right.
So of course, causal dynamical triangulations is a candidate quantum theory of gravity. And in this approach, what we do is we define a quantum amplitude as follows. Right? So an amplitude A is given by performing a particular path sum, where we sum over all causal triangulations T, subject to some boundary condition that defines the amplitude that we're interested in. Right? And so there's a measure factor in the sum, and then, of course, the exponential of I times the action for that causal triangulation. So what exactly is a causal triangulation? Well, it's a particular simplicial manifold that has a certain property. And the property is that it admits a global foliation by space-like hypersurfaces that all have the same topology. So when you evaluate this path sum, you need to pick some topology for the leaves of the foliation. All right. So in particular, this simplicial manifold is built out of these four types of four simplices. And each of these is a little piece of Minkowski space. So they're sort of oriented. So the bases of the simplices lie within one leaf of the foliation, and the edges that are space-like within that leaf have a length squared of a squared that gives us a lattice spacing. And then there are time-like edges that connect up to an adjacent leaf of the foliation. And those edges are scaled by a factor alpha. Right? So we just glue a bunch of these together, and we've formed a sort of layered structure, and that's how we build up a causal triangulation. All right. So although we've regulated the gravitational path integral with these causal triangulations, it's still quite difficult to analyze analytically. So what we do is that we Wick rotate the causal triangulations to Euclidean signature. And this is well defined because we have this global foliation. All right. So we Wick rotate, and we end up with a partition function. And now we just have the exponential of negative, the Euclidean action for the causal triangulation. So to study this partition function, we run Monte Carlo simulations, and we generate ensembles of representative causal triangulations. In particular, we have to run them at fixed T, where T is the total number of leaves in the foliation. At fixed N4, that's the total number of these simplices that we use to build up each causal triangulation. And then at fixed values for the bare couplings in the action that we choose to use. All right, we generate these ensembles of causal triangulations, and then we pick observables to numerically measure, and we take averages over the ensemble of those observables, and that's supposed to approximate the expectation value of that observable in the state defined by the partition function. So let's just look at one case. So Einstein gravity with positive cosmological constant, where we've taken the space-time topology to be S3 cross S1. So each leaf of the foliation is a three-sphere, and we've periodically identified in the time direction. So this is the most studied case. It turns out there are three phases in this case of the partition function. There's a phase A, where the geometry is sort of decoupled. There's a phase B, where the geometry is kind of crumpled. And then there's a phase C, where the geometry is physical, as I'll tell you about shortly. So I'm going to focus on phase C for the rest of the talk. All right. So in particular, I'm interested in an effective description of phase C on large scales. So I'm going to focus on one particular dynamical variable. And that's going to be this N3 SL of tau. Okay, so it's the number of space-like three simplices as a function of the discrete time tau, which just labels the leaves in the foliation of each causal triangulation. So in this graph, I'm showing you this dynamical variable, which you can think of as just the spatial volume as a function of time. And this is just for one representative causal triangulation in a particular ensemble. If I average the spatial volume over the ensemble, then I get something that looks like this. And this is sort of illustrating the characteristic feature of the geometry in phase C. So there's a portion of the time slices here and here, which are really connected because there's a periodic identification, where there's very, very little volume on that time slice. And this is called the stalk. And there's quite good evidence now that it's just a sort of artifact of how we run the lattice simulations. But then in the middle here, there's this nice portion where the volume modulates up and down quite nicely, and that's thought to be the physical portion of the ensemble average geometry. Okay. So besides looking at this dynamical variable, the spatial volume as a function of time, I'm also going to consider deviations from the spatial volume as a function of time. So if you compute the ensemble average deviation, you get a graph like this, which is also quite nice and regular. And if you look at the full covariance matrix, or propagator or correlator of these deviations, you get a matrix that looks like this, right? And this graph is just sort of a slice through here. All right. So given how nice and regular these ensemble averages look, right, you might think that there should be some effective description of the spatial volume as a function of time. So Ambjorn and collaborators tried to measure whether there is an effective action that describes the spatial volume as a function of time. And they used a few different methods in a series of papers. And they basically found that this effective action provides a very nice description, right? So there's just three terms, a kinetic term, a potential term, and a Lagrange multiplier term. And there are three effective coupling constants, C1, C2, and C3. Yeah. So try to keep that effective action in mind because I'm going to use it heavily in what follows. All right. So what am I interested in this talk? Right. So my aim is to extract the renormalization group flow of the cosmological constant. Right. Of course, the cosmological constant is a dimensionful coupling, but really we only ever measure dimensionless things, right? So I should really take some combination of coupling constants that's dimensionless and extract the renormalization group flow of that combination of couplings. So at least within the Einstein-Hilbert truncation of the effective action, essentially the only dimensionless product you can make is this one, Newton's constant times the cosmological constant. So I'm going to focus on that and extract that particular product of couplings. Right. And the idea will be to measure that product of couplings on a whole bunch of different effective length scales in units of the Planck length, and in that way get the renormalization group flow. All right. So my method draws quite heavily on this particular paper by Ambjorn and collaborators, although I've made a few modifications and some extensions. All right, so there are three steps. So the first step is to fit the effective action that I showed you on the last page to numerical measurements of two things, which I showed you before, right? So the ensemble average of this discrete spatial volume as a function of time, and the ensemble average covariance of the deviations from the ensemble average. So this fit is going to determine the effect of coupling C1, C2, and C3. All right. So then I'm just going to finite size scale the effective action towards the continuum limit in order to relate these effective couplings, C1, C2, and C3, to the gravitational couplings that I'm interested in. All right. And finally, the idea is to just generate multiple different ensembles which are hopefully characterized by different effective scales on which I'm making measurements of these two quantities. And in that way, to get the value of the product G times lambda at different scales. Right. So let me tell you a little bit more about the particulars of my method. All right. So first, let me tell you how I do the fit of the effective action. So the basic idea is to expand the effective action that I showed you a few slides ago in powers of the deviations from the ensemble average. Okay. So at zeroth order in this expansion, we're just looking at the ensemble average of this discrete spatial volume itself. Right? So this is the same plot I showed you, well, except that I've now done a fit of the data points. And in particular, I've done a fit of the data points to this functional form, which is just a discretization of the volume, the three volume, as a function of global time eta for Euclidean de Sitter spacetime. So this fit puts a constraint on C3, and it turns out that if you, for Euclidean de Sitter spacetime, the effect of coupling C2 is determined in terms of C3. All right. So at first order, right. Since the ensemble average is very well fit to Euclidean de Sitter, which is an extremum of the effective action, right? We expect the first functional derivatives of the effective action with respect to the deviations when you evaluate them on the effect on the ensemble average, right? We expect those derivatives to be approximately zero. So if I just compute these functional derivatives and set them to zero, I get a bunch of constraints on C1 and C3. If we then look at second order, here what we expect, as in standard perturbative quantum field theory, is that this covariance of the deviations in the spatial volume, or its inverse, should be well fit by 1 over h bar times the second functional derivative of the effective action. Okay. So I can measure this covariance, as I showed before, just numerically. And then I can fit it to the second functional derivatives of the effective action, and that gives me more constraints on C1 and C3. Okay. So I want to determine the effective coupling C1 and C3 in a consistent manner, right? So what I actually do is I simultaneously do all three of these fits and to extract the best fit values for C1 and C3. So I actually do it both ways and check for consistency, but yes. All right. So let me tell you a little bit about how I do this finite size scaling. Okay. So the idea is to scale tau, which, right, is the discrete time that labels the leaves of the foliation of each causal triangulation, and also to scale the discrete volume so as to find the continuum limit of the effective action. All right. So in causal dynamical triangulations, the naive continuum limit is the following. So if you take the lattice spacing and send that to zero, and simultaneously send the number of force simplices comprising each causal triangulation to infinity, you expect that the product of n4 and a to the fourth should remain, should be constant, and should be proportional to the continuum 4 volume. That's just what you expect on dimensional grounds. So if you use that naive continuum limit, this is what you expect for the scaling of tau and n3sl. So you expect tau to scale as n4 to the -1/4 power, and then that will be identified in the continuum with the dimensionless time. And you expect the spatial volume to scale as n4 to the -3/4 power, and the continuum that would map onto the dimensionless continuum volume. You might ask, this continuum limit is just based on dimensional analysis, right? Why should it necessarily be true? And indeed, right, you could have anomalous scalings, right? So that could be the case, but there's some good evidence that the naive continuum limit is quite likely correct. Here I'm just showing two little pieces of evidence. So this is the correlator of the volume with itself. The correlator has been scaled according to the naive continuum limit. And what this is showing, the different colors indicate different ensembles of causal triangulations at different values of n4, but for the same bare coupling constants. And they all scale very nicely onto the same continuum curve. Over here, I'm showing the spectral dimension actually in 2+1 dimensions. And the diffusion time has been scaled according to the naive continuum limit. And so the measured spectral dimension is the black line, and then it's been fit to basically the spectral dimension of de Sitter, which is the green on large scales. And the fit is quite nice, but only when you do that scaling. All right. So if you do this scaling, then you find that the continuum limit of the effective action has this particular form. All right. It turns out this effective action, the continuum limit of the effective action, is almost nothing but the effective action for Euclidean mini superspace model. The only difference is that a Euclidean mini superspace model would have a negative sign in front of it. But apparently the effective action that describes causal dynamical triangulations doesn't have that negative sign. Okay. All right, so before I show you the portion of the renormalization group flow that I've extracted, I just want to say that this is really preliminary. I've only very recently gotten these results. Okay. So here's the graph. Oh yeah, so unfortunately I only have 4 ensembles. But you need a lot of statistics for this kind of analysis, and that's all we've been able to generate so far, right? So here's the renormalized value of the product of G and lambda, and I'm plotting it against the effective de Sitter length for the de Sitter solution that I fit to my measurements. So these points are certainly going to have error bars, but I'm not yet completely confident in my estimations of those errors, so I thought I would just show, you know, generally what it looks like. Okay. All right, so there are a bunch of things still to do, right? First of all, you know, it'd be nice to have a lot more ensembles so I can get a little bit more of the renormalization group flow. I also still need to do a bunch of consistency checks, which I haven't really fully gone through, right? So the expansion of the effective action and powers of the deviations, I'm quite certain it is certainly valid, but I'd like to do some more quantitative tests of that. And I'd also like to include higher order terms in the effective action and see if there's any statistically significant effect when I do the fit with those higher order terms. Okay. Relatedly, I'd like to determine what the regime of validity of the Einstein-Hilbert truncation is in causal dynamical triangulations. I think that would be interesting. And then I'd like to apply this technique to the causal dynamical triangulations of Hojava-Lipschitz gravity. And I think eventually we'd like to compare these renormalization group flows to those that have been computed in the asymptotic safety approach. So I'll just finish by putting up a few acknowledgments. Thanks.
So then UV is towards the right, right?
So I'm making measurements of basically the spatial volume, so it's a large scale variable. So roughly the scale I'm measuring on is the de Sitter length, but I'm expressing it in units of the Planck length. So, right, so these are larger scales, right? Larger scales on which I'm making the measurement, and these are smaller scales on which I'm making the measurements.
Okay, because I mean, if you would try to interpret these 4 points, then it would rather seem like you're approaching some kind of fixed point behavior on the right side.
Maybe. Not sure.
Less speculative question.
It seems the product comes out in the right ballpark for asymptotic safety.
Okay.
So
the
values are not so surprising, let's say.
Yeah. I mean I am quite confident that the points are, you know, they're not orders of they're not an order of magnitude off, I would say.
Just for comparison, how large are the ensembles? Like, how many synthesis are?
Yeah, so it varies a little bit. So the largest ensembles are 130,000 simplices. And for those, I have about 10,000 members in the ensemble. And then there's one ensemble here that is, I think 80,000 simplices, and another that is 40,000. I think that's right.
In which direction does the size of the ensemble vary? Like, do you need larger ensembles if you want that direction or larger in that direction?
They're not all at the same coupling constants. They're not all the same bare coupling constants. So I actually don't remember offhand which points are which ensembles.
Just to comment, if you look at these higher order correction terms, the paper like 2 years ago, we didn't see to the effect of how they contribute to the effect of action for the scale factor. And they didn't, at least where the region were, they didn't
significant. So I haven't, so I have the sort of analysis in place to run this in 2+1 dimensions as well. So I could, but I haven't yet tried studying, doing the same analysis on the Herjavec-Lipschitz models that we studied. I mean, what we preliminarily saw was that there was probably not much in the way of higher order corrections.
Okay. But just look at the correlation. Just look at the correlation functions.
We only really looked at the ensemble average of the volume there. And we haven't run very large ensembles for those models yet. So I don't really have data.
Okay, so let's thank Joshua and all the speakers of the session.